and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're hearing from Ambassador Henry Crumpton, a 24-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service. After the events of 9/11, Ambassador Crumpton led the CIA's campaign in Afghanistan. Though now retired from government service, he was also named Ambassador at Large and the Coordinator for Counterterrorism at the U.S. Department of State. This event took place on September 9th of 2016 at the Hilton Hotel and was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. President and CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, Lisa Falsko, provides the introduction.
Hello, my name is Lisa Falsko. I'm CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. We are so delighted to see so many people here today. I want to thank Ambassador Crumpton for going to West High School today. He went there today and spoke to a group of over 85 students. And I'm really impressed with his passion for letting people know about what is intelligence and answer all sorts of questions that the students were throwing out at him, which I hope we'll have some of those today. He also wrote a book, if anyone hasn't read it, The Art of Intelligence. Highly recommend it, part of this quest of letting people understand what it means to be in the intelligence community and the important role of the men and women who serve our country. And for our introduction, I guess I need to tell a little bit of a story before that happens. About 5 years ago, I was sitting with a board member of ours, now a former board member, and we were brainstorming about potential speakers that could come to Alaska. And this board member said, you know, you really should invite Ambassador Crumpton. And I went, Ambassador Crumpton. He goes, you know 9/11? And I said, yes. And he said, well, so Ambassador Crumpton was responsible for the response in Afghanistan with Al-Qaeda. There's a 60-minute special. You should invite Ambassador Crumpton. So we did, and I'm so thrilled that you came all the way to Alaska to speak to our folks today. And so I went back to this board member, former board member, and said, would you like to introduce our speaker? You gave us the idea, and we'd like you to introduce him. And he said, I would love to. Problem is I'm in Washington, D.C. this week. Well, no worries. Thanks to technology, and hopefully maybe some ability with the technology, he recorded an introduction, and I'd like to play that today for all of you to introduce our speaker.
Good afternoon to my fellow members of the Alaska World Affairs Council. I'm really sorry I can't be with you today to listen to somebody who I believe is one of the truly great Americans that we have in our country. My friend, Ambassador Hank Crumpton, is going to be speaking to you today. I'm so excited that he made it to Alaska to speak in front of the World Affairs Council. I'm sure you have his bio in front of you, but you know, as we come upon the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, of course we remember the victims. We remember our brave military members, men and women, who responded to these attacks. But what we don't always remember are the members of the clandestine service who were literally on the ground before anybody, leading the attack against Al-Qaeda in warfare and risk-taking that truly has become legendary. I'm sure you're going to ask Ambassador Crumpton about Operation Jawbreaker, but that is the CIA operation after 9/11 that he literally led. And that the success of what happened over there after 9/11, in many ways, he spearheaded that. And that's true. Look at his bio. It's a remarkable bio. But the other thing you won't see in there is that Hank Crumpton is a humble man, just a humble, great American. And I am so honored to be able to introduce him and have him come to Alaska to share his wisdom with my fellow Alaskans. You know, the first time Ambassador Crumpton and I met, we kind of had a mind meld. I had just been appointed and confirmed by the Senate as a U.S. Assistant Secretary of State in charge of economic, finance, terrorist finance issues. But I had been on active duty the previous year and a half as a Marine, and spent a lot of time in the regions of the world that Hank's very familiar with, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Middle East, the what's called the CENTCOM area of responsibility. So when I became Assistant Secretary of State, really one of the first places I wanted to go, the first place I did go in that position as a diplomat was back to Pakistan and Afghanistan and even the border regions called the Fatah. Because there's this notion in our military, but beyond that, effective foreign policy, we need to use all instruments of American power. Not just the kinetic aspects, the military aspects, but economic, trade, finance. And so that's what I was going to do over there. And I went to meet with Ambassador Crumpton, who at that time was the head of all counterterrorism for the State Department. And we literally had a great discussion on how important it was to do this, to bring all instruments of U.S. power. And if there's anyone who has done that throughout his career that understands it, it's Ambassador Crumpton. So we had a great meeting then, became good friends, worked on a lot of issues together during his time and my time at the State Department. But again, I am so pleased, again, on the 15th anniversary of 9/11, that literally one of the heroes of the American response against Al-Qaeda and the terrorist groups that brought that destruction to our shores, that he's in Alaska to meet with all of you and to, provide his wisdom to a great group of Alaskans. So, without further ado, please give a warm welcome to my friend and a great American, Ambassador Hank Crumpton.
What a wonderful, gracious introduction by Senator Sullivan. And he's why I'm here. When I got the invitation, I think the call was last year at some point, and I learned that Senator Sullivan had put my name forward. Well, my response was, of course, just tell me when and I'll be there. So very grateful for the invitation. Very grateful for the work that the council does. It's so important for communities to be involved and to understand the greater globe that we inhabit and to learn about the growing complexities and challenges and opportunities that we face. And organizations like the Council have got an important role to play. Also like to recognize again the students that are here and also the men and women serving our nation in the military and perhaps other capacities here. Let me thank you for your service. I've been out of government for more than 10 years and I just in awe of some of the men and women who continue to serve in so many different ways. And so first and foremost, let me thank you for that and for the chance to speak here today. I always wanted to be a spy. I grew up in a small town in Georgia, and my daddy's a forester and my mother's a school teacher. In fact, tomorrow I'm flying to visit with them in their hometown where they've been since 1960. It was a great environment to grow up. Warren County, Georgia, between Macon and Augusta. You could hunt, you could fish, you could play sports, and you could learn. And our house was a great place to learn. Lots of books, lots of opportunities to go to the library, to explore. And I knew fairly early on that I wanted to serve my country. Our family had a tradition of military service for generations. All four of my paternal uncles were combat veterans of World War II, all survived. My father, who was the youngest of nine in that family, he briefly served in the 101st Airborne. But for lots of reasons, I gravitated pretty quickly toward irregular warfare, toward subversion and sabotage and intelligence captured my imagination, perhaps because I read a book about Francis Marion, also known as the Swamp Fox, the operations he ran in the Revolutionary War in the lowlands of the Carolinas against the British forces really stirred my imagination. And so, later on, I applied to the CIA. I outlined my qualifications and my desire to serve and was rejected. Had a letter that came back and said, thanks for your interest, but we would encourage you to gain more education, more experience, and then reapply. Now, I can understand why I got that response, because I wrote that letter when I was perhaps 10 years old. But some kind soul in the CIA took the time to write back. I can only imagine it was some boyhood scrawl on some line rule paper, and I apparently sent it to CIA Washington, D.C., and it landed there. But it was pretty remarkable coming home from school that day, and my mother had laid that letter on my desk, and it had the CIA seal and letterhead. And so I took their advice. I did reapply, and I joined the CIA when I was 23. I was the youngest in my trainee class. I'm still not sure why they hired me. I was also not only the youngest, but I think probably the least qualified. But it was a wonderful opportunity to learn, to grow, and eventually find a way to contribute. And there are many qualities, I think, that it's important to be an intelligence officer and to be a leader. And I think one of that's a natural curiosity and a willing to learn. But the best way to learn is to explore and to experiment and make some mistakes and course correct and keep learning and keep moving forward. And I had plenty of opportunity to do that because I was assigned to Africa and had 10 years in sub-Saharan Africa, different countries. And remember, in the 1980s, this was in the Cold War. So the hot battles of the Cold War were being waged across many parts of Africa. And for a young CIA operations officer, undercover, there's no better place to be. There was so much volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity in these geopolitical environments. It was a great challenge and a great opportunity. And I learned those lessons in spades later on after 9/11 when I was given the privilege and honor to organize and lead CIA forces into Afghanistan. We looked at Afghanistan, and it was not really a nation state. It was a safe haven for Al-Qaeda, who had organized and led that horrible attack on our homeland, killing more than 3,000 people. Anniversary is just 2 days away, 15 years. But Afghanistan wasn't really a nation state. It was a volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous environment, VUCA, V-U-C-A. Some of you in the military will recognize that acronym. It's a shifting mosaic of tribal alliances. But we were confident of our mission because in September of 99, 2 years before 9/11, I deployed the first team into Afghanistan to build out these intelligence networks and to learn not only about Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and the enemy, but also about our allies and potential allies. And over the next 2 years, we sent more teams into Afghanistan to build out these networks. And on 9/11, although we failed to know when and where Al-Qaeda would attack, we did know an attack was coming. And we did know it would originate in Afghanistan. And that's why on that horrible day, despite the CIA's shortcomings, we had more than 100 sources in Afghanistan, in every province, among every tribe. And we had the Taliban penetrated. We even had parts of Al-Qaeda, their logistics infrastructure, penetrated. So when given the mission, the responsibility to respond to 9/11, we had friends in Afghanistan, and we started dropping teams into country. The first team was Jawbreaker, went into the Panjshir Valley 10 days after 9/11. And then the other teams, Alpha, Brava, Charlie, Echo, Foxtrot, Delta were all dropped in. 90 days later, less than 90 days later, Kandahar had fallen. It was the last urban stronghold of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. At that point, 10, 20, maybe 30,000 enemy had been dead. The Taliban were fleeing to Pakistan. 25% of Al-Qaeda leadership had been killed. We had recovered more than 20 important intelligence sites, including anthrax laboratories Al-Qaeda was operating near Kandahar, exploiting these sites for intelligence, feeding the intelligence to our friendly liaison services around the world so they could wrap up cells. Less than 90 days after 9/11. How many Americans were on the ground? 410. 110 CIA officers and about 300 special forces. So when you hear about the invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11, don't be afraid to correct who's ever making that comment, because it was not an invasion. It's a crucial lesson that we never learned or forgot. It was an initial victory for us, but it was importantly a victory for our Afghan allies, because we had encouraged, recruited, and supported Afghan tribal leaders and their people across the country. They were the ground force. Tens of thousands rallied to this opportunity to overthrow the Taliban and to drive out the true invaders, the Al-Qaeda operatives, the Arabs and Chechens and Uyghurs and Pakistanis who had come in and hijacked their country. That's how we framed this war, because that was the geopolitical reality. It was an Afghan victory. There's nothing more important on the battlefield than pride and prestige and honor. Thucydides taught us that in his wonderful book, The Peloponnesian War. It applied then, it certainly applies now. Put yourself in the shoes of an Afghan tribal leader in November of 2001. You have 500 warriors. They need weapons, they need ammunition, they need intelligence, they need air cover. But you also have a couple of thousand women and children. These are your responsibility. These are your constituents. So you turn to that small team of CIA officers, now by November accompanied by special forces, with a request. I need clothes, I need food, I need medical supplies. And yes, I need weapons, but I've got to take care of my people. Within 48 hours, this request was falling from the sky, those specific materials. Think about the prestige and the pride and the honor conveyed upon those tribal leaders when their American allies respond in such a fashion. Between mid-October and mid-December 2001, working with the U.S. Air Force, we dropped 1.69 million pounds of goods into Afghanistan. 110 airdrops into 41 different locations, each drop tailor-made to what our Afghan ally requested. That's how you win wars. It's about an empathetic understanding. It's about shared risk. It's about listening and learning and responding to your allies' needs. That's why we had that initial success. Why are we still in Afghanistan 15 years later? We failed to win the peace. It's what Senator Sullivan referred to. That first 20%, that hard power, that military application of lethal force, it's necessary when people are trying to kill you. And make no doubt, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and their affiliates, that's their goal. They would hope to come to a place like Anchorage, to a conference like this, and kill everybody in this room. That's their goal. You need military force to deal with them. But that's just the first 20%. The next 80% is about winning the peace. all those instruments of state power that we need to learn how to harness. And whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Libya or Yemen, we're winning the initial fights. We can secure a village and a valley. But what next? That's what we haven't figured out yet. That's what we need to learn. There are many different ways to apply this. And I'm not advocating for nation building, for having a mirror image of the world and trying to build liberal democracies like ours, because it won't work. But what can work is a modicum of security, a degree of freedom, education, the empowerment of women is crucial, and plant the seeds for liberal institutions to take hold, because that's the foundation for a liberal democracy. Have an election? Insufficient. It must be built on liberal institutions, and that's where we need to do a lot more work. We need to have a lot deeper partnerships. The environments that I learned in Africa and Afghanistan and elsewhere were VUCA, V-U-C-A. What about the world today? Less that way or more? I would argue for more, a lot more. And not just in the sense of terrorism, but what about the marketplace? Are the markets volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous? Yeah. What about you guys here in the oil industry? What about in the high-tech world? Anybody doing business in China here? It's a definition of complexity, an ambiguity, uncertainty, volatility. This trend is just not going to continue. It's going to accelerate. But the good news, you can win in those environments. You can succeed. You can accomplish your objectives. But what does it take to do so? On the battlefield and the marketplace, there's some very similar qualities required. One is leadership. And not just any kind of leadership, not just command and control leadership, but virtuous leadership. When's the last time you heard that word, virtue? It's an important word. We should think about that, starting with knowing who we are. This is what a liberal education is all about. For all of you students here in particular, knowing who you are is where it begins. This is what the ancients taught us. There's an analogy that I sometimes use. When you're dropped into a foreign environment, the first thing you do after you secure your position is to make sure you're in the right place. You pull out your GPS. Am I on the map where I should be? Because if you're not, and you start trying to triangulate that ridge or that river valley, everything's going to be off. Well, it's the same thing in your personal and professional relationships. If you don't know who you are and why you are making the decisions you are, how are you going to have an enduring, trusting relationship? That's where leadership starts. And there, of course, it's about execution. It's about disciplined execution. Whatever business you may be in, how do you do your job? And there's no substitute for a lot of hard work and practice, thousands and thousands of hours to develop that skill. In the operations world, we would call it tradecraft or tactics. The same thing applies in business and academia and elsewhere. You've got to be able to execute. So you start with virtuous leadership, which is about learning about yourself and others in the world. And then you have to learn how to execute whatever mission you have embraced. And the third part, you have to collaborate. What I learned in those hard years in Africa and later on in Afghanistan is that if you don't have trusted allies, if you don't have a dynamic, flexible, trusted network, it's really hard, maybe impossible, to achieve your goals. That's why a lot of the major corporations today, the ones that are changing, that are succeeding, They've developed trusted networks. They have their own venture capital arms. So they can provide capital to startups so they can learn, so they can build their networks beyond the command and control corporate environment. Academia is doing the same thing. You look at Georgetown University with their campuses in the Middle East, with their partnerships with other universities, what they're doing in China. It's certainly true in the intelligence business. Building collaborative networks. And what's the key to that? Trust. And sometimes that's about shared risk. Virtuous leadership, disciplined execution, trusted networks for collaboration. And what's the fourth? Innovation. You've got to create. You've got to get outside your comfort zone to do that. During the Afghan campaign, we deployed a Predator drone. In fact, it was even before 9/11. Back in the summer of 2000, these human networks I had described earlier, they had deployed near Kandahar, and they were reporting the presence of bin Laden at a particular camp at a particular date. And our teams were deployed, and I tried to get authorities to engage with lethal force under our covert action authorities, and I could not because of the uncertainty, the perceived unreliability of our human sources on the ground. The policymakers in Washington said, no, we can't afford that risk. This was a full year before 9/11. So we failed to seize that opportunity. Soon thereafter, we had another report from the same human source networks on the ground saying bin Laden would be at this place, this time. By then, however, we had a Predator drone, unarmed, in the air. We flew the drone over this particular site, and there's bin Laden. Tall, white robes, security detail. We had just confirmed our human source reporting. You can go to 60 Minutes and see the clip. They declassified that video feed now. And so we told the White House, we have him. And they said, well, if we engage with lethal force, we want to use cruise missiles launched from submarines in the Indian Ocean. That would take about 6 hours to reach there. So you need to tell us where he's going to be 6 hours from now. That's not a joke. In response to that, we innovated. We said, okay, next time we see him, we'll have our own munitions, our own ability to fire immediately. You fast forward to February 2001. It was the first test fire shot out in the Nevada desert. And that's why when 9/11 rolled around, after some bureaucratic tussle, President Bush gave CIA the authorities to wage war using lethal drones. Innovation driven by frustration, necessity, and an imperative to defend our nation. There are many other examples of innovation. But what's key? You must seize the opportunity that a crisis can give you, and you must have the imagination and the collaborative networks to pull off something like that. It wasn't just the CIA. You had some remarkably heroic officers in the Air Force that were collaborating. You had contractors. You had a whole range of intelligence specialists from different parts of the government that came together. By the time we put the Predator program together, more than a dozen agencies representative in CIA headquarters in that command center that we had built. It was about collaboration. It goes hand in hand with innovation. We look across the world today, there are some terrific challenges. North Korea, had a discussion with the students this morning at the high school about North Korea. They just detonated their fifth nuclear test, the largest yet, 5.3 on the Richter scale. 5 tests in 10 years, but what's concerning is that 3 of those tests have been just in the last few months. They're not only getting bigger, they're coming closer together. That matched with their advances in missile capability, big concern, particularly here in Alaska. We need to think about nation states like North Korea and have much better policies China, Russia. Russia pushing hard. You look at their annexation of Crimea, their occupation of other parts of eastern Ukraine, their cyber attacks against our own political system. China and the South China Sea, on and on and on. But let me mention three very unique positive things that are going on that you may not have heard of. Because it's about risk, but it's also about some opportunity. Anybody know where the most advanced, comprehensive national infrastructure is for drones? Rwanda. It's a tiny country in Africa. The president of Rwanda heard about an entrepreneur in California with a particular type of drone, so he sent him an email and said, I want you to come here and build out our national infrastructure. That was 2 years ago. The reason is that Rwanda, pretty progressive little country in Africa, but they don't have a lot of roads, and it's hard to build because it's a very mountainous, hilly country, and they have villages scattered all over, and there's a dire need for medicine and blood and emergency supplies, and that means timely delivery. So they're building drone ports all over Rwanda. And within another year or two, they'll be able to reach almost any place in the country within about 30 to 60 minutes to deliver medicine. That's pretty fascinating. What country on the planet has got the most renewable energy resources? More than 80% of all their energy comes from renewables. Uruguay in Latin America. What country in the world has the most mobile payments per capita than any place on the planet? Kenya. Local software engineers developed a way that they can use text messages to transfer money. More than 60% of the transactions in Kenya are made by mobile payment. It's having a profound impact, not just on the economy, but on society and the political systems. One reason is that women are now controlling the money because they control the telephone. It's a really big deal. If you had to pick the single most important social variable measuring political success and stability and economic progress, the empowerment of women. Social scientists agree. And this transcends cultures. There are lots of fascinating things going on. But the only way to understand and to seize those opportunities is to map and to navigate these VUCA environments. And you can only do that with virtuous leadership, disciplined execution, collaborative networks, and innovation, relentless innovation, which is tough because that means taking risk. It means some failures and some course corrections. But we can all learn, we can all do better. So when you guys move forward, think about the VUCA world and think about not just the risk, but think about the opportunities and find the courage to seize them. Let me close and open it up for questions, please.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from Ambassador Henry Crumpton as he spoke to the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel. We return now to the program as Ambassador Crumpton answers questions from the audience.
And with that, I hope all of you ask a question. We'll leave it over to our speaker.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Roger Hudson. I heard you say that 80% of the task is winning the peace. The 9/11 Commission, one of their major recommendations was in the area of education. You mentioned it briefly. The other day, the U.S. House passed an Education for All Act, which hasn't got through the Senate yet, but the goal is for bilateral and multilateral institutions to really encourage developing country and unstable country leaderships to put a higher priority on educating their populations. I wonder if you have any general comments about the importance of that issue in the long run. You know, a lot of ISIS and Al-Qaeda recruits come through the madrasa system, where the only option that parents have to get their kids to even learn to read is a competing ideology. Do you have any general observations about the task?
Sure. I think that's one of the key elements of what I referred to as winning the peace. I should note that the 20-80% formula is not mine. It's David Galola, who's was a French warrior and political theorist who wrote a book on counterinsurgency back in the 1960s. And so this is not a new idea. It's something he saw in the Algerian War. He saw it in Southeast Asia. And he made the point that you've got to bring all of civil society together. It's a comprehensive battle, and education is a key piece of it. You know, tragically, we're still fighting in Afghanistan 15 years later, and it's because we failed to win the peace. If you look in 02 to 05, after the initial success I described, you had a huge window of opportunity. And we, of course, made the mistake of invading Iraq, and that was an invasion, and failed to follow up and win the peace. The good news in Afghanistan, 2001, almost no women were going to school. Today, millions of girls go to school. And if you're the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, that's your worst nightmare, because they're going to grow up, they're going to become leaders in business and government and academia, and they will challenge that awful, brutal ideology. So the short answer is yeah. It's crucial. And not only overseas, it's crucial here to our own well-being. I mean, you look at the number of 18-year-olds that do not graduate from high school or may have a degree but in paper only. And it's not only an issue of education, it's an issue of national security. Because we have to have the people that understand the world in which we spy and fight and engage in business and learn. So it's a huge part of it. That's what my mother taught me a long time ago. Yes?
So I always like to say that the people who are in the best position to constructively criticize a government agency are the ones who worked within the agency itself. So I was curious, do you have any criticisms of the way that the CIA has operated, or mistakes or shortcomings? And I was kind of looking, if at all possible, for something a little bit more specific than just the failure of nation building.
Yeah, sure. I wrote a book about it. there are many criticisms. Let me make one in particular, not just about the CIA, but about the U.S. government response. Post 9/11, it has been overwhelmingly Washington-centric, if you look at the response. A director of national security, the National Counterterrorism Center, the Department of Homeland Security. Washington Post did a expose a couple of years ago, and they came up with 1,000 different government departments and agencies that had some role in the counterterrorism mission. Well, how do you win? Well, if I can refer to the example of my men in Afghanistan, 0102, you get virtuous leaders in the field, and you give them not only the responsibility, but the authority, and then the support to do the job. In other words, we should have much more of a field bias than we do now. We cannot get inside the turning radius of the enemy, inside their decision cycle, when you're sitting in Washington, D.C. There is no way to do that. But if you look at 0102 in Afghanistan, you look at the surge in Iraq under General Petraeus, you had field commanders that were empowered and were given the tools and the opportunity to execute. And you have to have the right leadership. You have to have the right collaborative networks and allies to do that. You need the right political support. I was fortunate to have all of that in place. Well, we can do a lot better job, but it needs to be in the field. Our ambassadors is an example. The discretionary spending of a U.S. ambassador overseas, it is infinitesimal. I mean, they have to make decisions about, do I have one reception this month or two? And you compare that to the amount of money that we spend as a government, the trillions, is way out of whack. And I could give you example after example. Let me offer another book. It's about John Boyd, B-O-Y-D. He was a fighter pilot, and he was given the task of understanding why we were losing dogfights in the Korean War when we had better aircraft. And he developed a very simple, very elegant explanation. It's called the OODA loop. He said the enemy pilots, they could observe, they could orient, decide, and act, O-O-D-A, faster than our pilots. So from that, he extrapolated several great lectures on the theory of war. And he said a OODA loop is essential to victory. Well, those teams that we dropped into Afghanistan, man, their OODA loops were so tight and they were networked with each other. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda, they had no idea what hit them. We could do that again. That's a long answer to your question, but a good one. Thanks.
Hi, I was just wondering what needs to be done on a civilian level to prevent terrorism from kind of coming in from within the country. You know, people of my age wanting to join ISIS and working on their own. What needs to be done on our level to prevent that from happening?
Yeah, that's a really good question. What are the responsibilities of U.S. citizens to deal with radicalization within our own ranks? It begins at a community level. When I talk about a field bias, it's not just overseas, it's here in the United States also. I think that except for New York Police Department, LAPD's pretty good. Dallas is not bad, but we have a long way to go into building out our local intelligence capabilities. And I'm not necessarily talking about undercover operations, although that's a part of it. It's first and foremost about trusted networks. I mean, what's more effective than a beat cop who's got great relationships with local vendors and clergy and teachers? And what about the responsibility of all of us, not just those in government? We have a responsibility for our citizens and for each other in bringing people into a sense of community, a sense of mission is crucial. One thing I've advocated for, again, with zero success, is national service. I don't see why every 18 and 19-year-old can't serve this country. And not necessarily in the military. Teach for America is a great organization. You look at all the infrastructure in our national parks that need repair. You look at the medical needs. There's so many ways that I think that our young citizens could contribute. And I think in part that would address some of the question you have. And it's not only radicalization that concerns me. It's this growing gap between elites in our country and everybody else. I think that's an issue also. And national service, I think, in part could address some of that. But again, it begins, you know, the late Speaker of the House, that wonderful leader, a Democrat, Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts, what a great guy. He talked about all politics being local. Well, so is all counterterrorism. So is all intelligence. It's about local knowledge. It's about those trusted collaborative networks. That's far more effective than any satellite or UAV in the sky, I promise you.
Good afternoon, I'm Steve McKeever. I was a bit shocked the other day to find that there's an organization that sells to governments the ability to turn on my cell phone without my knowledge and listen to my conversations and actually turn the camera on and things. I'm sure in your career you've seen electronic surveillance become a much more impressive tool for counterintelligence and intelligence. Just what are your thoughts on that balance between the freedoms that we enjoy as Americans and our security? You know, what freedoms do we give up for that security?
I'm a strong supporter of civil liberties because that's the foundation for liberal institutions, for our democracy, and for our country. The best intelligence, it's not about clandestine surveillance. but that tends to dominate the intelligence discussion, in part because of the advances in technology. If it's up to me, I would have more limitations on that type of surveillance and more emphasis on empowering local and state authorities in building out those community networks I talk to. I think that's far more effective and certainly far less intrusive. It goes to my earlier point about the centralization of authorities and data and power in Washington, D.C. I think that's a problem. I, in fact, even am concerned that you have the FBI with all the great work they do, and I served there for a year. The CIA loaned me to the FBI for a year. It was a wonderful experience and opportunity. But I question the need for us to have one agency that both has both the law enforcement powers and the lead in intelligence collection in the U.S. You know, other industrialized, developed democracies in the, around the world, they have that separate. You see that in Australia, you see that in England, you see that in other places. And part of my concern is civil liberties. Why would you have that all centered in one place? It's a bigger trend that is, I think, worrisome, and we haven't addressed it sufficiently. So good question. Thank you.
You stated that the in order to have a liberal democracy, you have to have liberal institutions. And what do you presume that we do in with specific examples in order to incorporate that in other places in order to have the peace that we want?
Sure. Good question. A part of it is technology as an answer. I've made this recommendation, and again without success, but if you looked at all the villages in Afghanistan and the availability of renewable energy, and they have intense solar radiation, you've got great wind power, you have biomass there, you could electrify every village in Afghanistan for a small fraction of what we've spent in our military budget there. And then you connect every village by satellite. And so you have television, you have telecommunications, telemedicine, education. But you also would buy a big TV screen and you'd put it in the center of every village and you would pump in about 20 years of Oprah reruns. That's how you empower women, how you build liberal institutions. I'm only half joking. Those are the kind of things that we should think about when we think of, okay, what's innovative? If you empower families and people, I don't care what culture you're in, what part of the world you're in, most of them have got the same interests and aspirations and hopes that we do. They want to take care of their families. They want to educate their kids. They want a better life. You just have to find ways to give them that opportunity. And, of course, they first have to have a modicum of security. They've got to be able to walk to school and not get raped or killed. They have to have basic access to these opportunities. And that doesn't require nation building. That just requires a little investment, some innovation, and some trusted partners on the ground. Media is a key piece of this, too. And I think that's a disruptive element in a very positive way. It gives China great concern. You know, China spends more on their internal security than their external defense. And they're concerned about this. They're concerned about liberal institutions gaining traction and challenging the Communist Party. I can give you a lot of other examples. But instead of just electoral democracy, we need to think about planting the seeds for liberal institutions. And in time, in the right place, with the right encouragement, perhaps liberal democracies can take hold.
You mentioned that the empowerment of women is key for the world to move forward and become a better place, especially in the Middle East, where women don't have as many rights as Western women do. But it also specifically states in Islamic religion that women are lesser than men. Of course, we all want women and men to be equal across the world, but where do you draw the line between empowering women and going to another culture and altering their religion?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are various interpretations of Islam. I think most of those that adhere to the Islamic faith have no problem with women asserting their rights. Let me give you an example. The United Arab Emirates, one of our best allies in the Middle East, they were directing airstrikes against ISIS in Syria. You know who led the first airstrike? The female fighter pilot. Arab Muslim female fighter pilot in the Emirates Air Force. The Emirates now in Jordan, Indonesia, you have plenty of women that are in positions of authority and power. And Indonesia is the largest Muslim country on the planet. So I think when you get to interpretations of Islam, they vary greatly. But overall, women have got a vote. And in the long term, it's something that benefits us all. I've certainly learned that in my household.
Pastor Crumpton, Mead Treadwell. We've had speakers here at the World Affairs Council over time talked about the end of the Cold War and the importance of Charlie Wilson's war in Afghanistan mm-hmm. and the CIA operations there in the early 80s. Can you tell us, when you arrived in Afghanistan and picked up the network, how much of a network was left? When did the Taliban move from being an ally to not being an ally, and what might we have done in that intervening period that maybe even could have prevented 9/11?
Yeah, great question. The late Congressman Charlie Wilson from Texas was instrumental in securing the resources that the CIA used to support the Afghans in their war against the Soviet Union. You recall the Soviet Union had occupied Afghanistan, and the Afghans, with the CIA's help, were able to eventually push them out. And Charlie Wilson was instrumental. In fact, he was key to that program. A great book, great movie. Tom Hanks plays Charlie Wilson. At the end of both the book and the movie, it makes the same point that I just made earlier. They failed to win the peace. Charlie Wilson is such a poignant moment because the Soviets leave, and as soon as that happens, the U.S. government forgets about Afghanistan. They just move on. And he's heartbroken because he had promised the Afghan people that we would stick with you, not to continue waging war, but to help them rebuild their country, which had been just horribly destroyed by the Soviet occupation. But we, as a government, didn't do that. That was the final sad point of that book. To your question about when we returned to Afghanistan, really in 1999, even before that, some elements of the CIA had maintained some relationships with our Afghan allies, particularly Ahmad Shah Massoud. And so the Afghans were receptive, but they were also cautious, even suspicious. I had more than one ask me, are you going to stay with us this time? I hope we do. And if I may, let me relate a story that goes to your question. Who here has heard of Ahmad Shah Massoud? Yeah, good, a few hands, yeah. He was known as the Lion of the Panjshir Valley, which is north of Kabul. And the Soviets, despite all their military power, they were never able to occupy the Panjshir because of Massoud and his men. He's a great warrior, very charismatic, brilliant man. And I met with him about 18 months before 9/11. It was up on the border regions of Afghanistan, and we were meeting in a little house and had a small fire going. It was pretty brutal weather outside. But Afghans are very gracious hosts, so we had hot sweet tea, had nuts and dried fruit, and had our maps of Afghanistan spread all over. And we were talking about our joint intelligence programs, about what we could do against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And it was a great discussion. He's a great guy. He had a very weathered, deeply lined face, and he's a very polite man. But after our long discussion, at the end, he asked if he could inquire of me one more thing, and I said, of course. And he said, I have great respect for your leaders, and I have gratitude for the support that you're giving us in our fight. But do your leaders care more about Al-Qaeda and finding bin Laden, or more about the people of Afghanistan? The answer is pretty obvious. I said, well, we care more about Al-Qaeda. I mean, the only element of the U.S. government engaging with anyone in Afghanistan was a small office in the CIA, and our responsibility, our mission was very specific, very narrow, was focused on Al-Qaeda. So I told him the truth, and he nodded and gave me a sad smile. Reminds me of Charlie Wilson in the end of the book. Tragically, Massoud was assassinated by Al-Qaeda 2 days before 9/11. It was part of the 9/11 plot. Two Al-Qaeda operatives posing as journalists detonated an explosive device hidden in a camera and killed Massoud. But thanks to his help and a lot of brave men and women of the CIA, we had been able to develop those networks over the years and to respond. Now, the lesson I take away from that, it's a leadership lesson. One is, I think Massoud was asking me that question. I mean, he knew the answer. I think he was asking me to see if I had enough gumption to tell him the truth. And that goes to virtuous leadership. And secondly, as good leaders do, he was trying to teach me something. And this was a man who could find, engage, and destroy the enemy, no problem. He'd been doing it his entire adult life. But that was only part of it. The other part was taking care of the people, is winning the peace. And this applies not just on the battlefield, but in the marketplace. You may have a specific business objective. You may want to reach your goal. You may want to get to that bottom line. But if you're not thinking about your customers and your employees and your investors and your partners and your people, you're not doing the job. I think that's an important lesson from Massoud also. Is how do we build not just success, but build collaborative networks and innovation along the way? Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been listening to Ambassador Henry Crumpton, a 24-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service and one-time ambassador at large and the coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. Department of State. He was speaking at the Hilton Hotel on September 9th of 2016 at an event sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA Anchorage, I'm your host and producer, Eric Bork.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.